Statistics and accounts of opioid-related deaths make the headlines in most newspapers almost daily. Are there alternative options available to alleviate this epidemic? Join me, Corinne Fregoni, in a conversation with Dr. Diane Dickinson, a local physician who has developed a deep fund of knowledge about medical cannabis. Coming up next on Through the Eyes of Women. Stay tuned. Welcome to Through the Eyes of Women, a program featuring the lives and perspectives of women, local, national, and international. Here are some horrifying statistics. In 2016, some 64,000 Americans died of drug overdose deaths, more than died during all the years of the Vietnam War. In 2017, that number rose to 72,000, higher than deaths from car crashes. U.S. Americans account for 5% of the world's population and consume 80% of the world's opioids. We're using opioids to such an extent that some countries have trouble accessing opioids for essential needs like post-surgical or end-of-life treatment. As a physician wrote recently, quote, "The epidemic that began largely in the doctor's office could not be contained there," end quote. Despite the widespread prescribing of opioids for chronic pain, the evidence that opioids actually help with this condition is weak, and too often a high number of people use prescription opioids end up abusing heroin. People with chronic pain do suffer. What can be done? It's been almost 8 years since I interviewed Diane Dickinson about medical marijuana. There have been a lot of changes in the field, and today Diane is going to explore the recent research and applications of this remarkable and complex plant, especially as it relates to treating pain. Welcome, Diane, to our show.
Thank you very much, Corinne.
Tell us a little history about cannabis.
Well, I think anyone who's looked at it at all realizes that there is ancient evidence of use of cannabis going back as far as 8,000 years in tombs, but the first written evidence of human cannabis use was 6th century BCE. And then it was used as a pharmaceutical medication extensively in the 1800s. It was in the 1851 first pharmacopoeia of the United States, and it was listed as an analgesic or pain reliever, a sleeping medication, and an anti-seizure medication. Just an aside, William O'Shaughnessy in the 1830s and 40s was working for the British Tea Company in England and Ireland, went to India to as part of his job, and learned about cannabis and was the first Western medical doctor to start using it as medicine, and wrote the first medical journal article, which is still amazing to read today. By the mid-1800s, it was probably in 50% of the patent medications that were available over the counter, and also pharmacists were using it in combination medications. It did decrease in use around the 1900s because opioids were available, aspirin, syringes became available for medications, and barbiturates. So it gradually started to decrease in the early 1900s, and that's when the controversy also started.
Tell us about that controversy.
So there's one man who is responsible for a lot of the stigma and propaganda. His name is Harry Anslinger. He was the first commissioner of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which was established in 1933. There were a few things going on. There was a lot of lobbying against cannabis use because, for one thing, Henry Ford actually built a car out of hemp. And the industrialists lobbied heavily against this use. The only steel that was in the car was some metal tubing in the frame. It also ran on ethanol, so there was a lot of lobbying from the petroleum industry. But the way they attacked it was a lot of racism. And Harry Anslinger really promoted that it was used primarily by jazz musicians in Harlem and Mexican farm workers. And that's really when the word marijuana started to be used, which is considered by many to be a racist term. It was called cannabis all through the 1800s, and if you look at the pharmacopoeia, it is cannabis, not marijuana.
Oh, that's interesting. Did you yourself support legalization of cannabis?
I did support legalization of cannabis in that I saw many people going to prison that should not have been going to prison for the use of a plant for their medical ailments. And that was a primary reason that I voted for it. I knew it wasn't a perfect law, and it certainly has been a struggle to implement for many parts of the community.
Well, that could be a whole nother show. We're going to continue with the medical aspects. Tell us about the chemical components of this remarkable plant.
The two main components are THC and CBD, or cannabidiol, and these are the ones you hear the most about. The current number of identified cannabinoids is 144. The second is terpenes. The current estimate is that there's more than 200 in the plant. Terpenes are what make everything in the world smell. Roses, lilacs, garbage, cannabis. And they have therapeutic effects. And every strain of cannabis has many terpenes. And there is a discussion and a term called the entourage effect, that when you use the plant as a whole, you get all of these chemicals together as they were made in nature. And there is benefit to that.
Would you say that cannabis is one of the more complex plants on the planet?
It really is. And the identification of the chemistry of the plant is very interesting. Raphael Meshulam is an absolutely delightful gentleman. He turned 88 in November. He lives in Israel. And around 1960, he was a biochemist with his own lab. Nobody really understood what was in cannabis. A few cannabinoids had been identified in the 1930s and 40s, but not extensively, and the structure was not known. So he decided to take on that study. By 1963, he had identified and isolated CBD, determined the chemical structure, and synthesized it. But nobody knew what it did for decades because it was not intoxicating. And then the very next year, 1964, he isolated THC, same thing, determined the chemical structure, and synthesized it. And 24 years later, a team of five other researchers did a very interesting experiment. What they did was they took THC, they added a radio tag to the molecule, which means that it would show up on an X-ray. They injected that combination into a rat, and they took an X-ray of the rat. And what they thought they'd see is the whole rat kind of light up on X-ray, and instead it was all in his brain. And they were completely mystified. They then talked a human volunteer into doing the same thing. It was all in his brain. So the only reason these researchers could come up with for this event was that there had to be a receptor in the brain hanging on to the THC. So they put the word out in the scientific cannabis community that they thought there was a receptor for a cannabinoid in the brain. And the scientists were like, No. The way biology works, we would never make a receptor for a plant. It just wouldn't happen. But just like we make endorphins, which are opiates, which we make in our bodies, and that's why we have opiate receptors. That is why morphine works after surgery. That is why people get addicted to heroin, because we have these receptors. So the scientists were like, well, we make opioids. Maybe we make cannabinoids. Let's go look. So they all were looking. It took Raphael Meshulam 2 years, but he identified the first cannabinoid, which we all make in our bodies, called anandamide. And he's very sweet, and he had a gentleman in his lab who was studying Sanskrit at the time. So ananda, part of the word, it means bliss in Sanskrit. So at this current point, where we're at with these is there are two very thoroughly studied cannabinoids, which we all make, anandamide and 2-AG. And then there are two very thoroughly studied receptors, which are not just in the brain. They were just first found in the brain, but they are virtually everywhere in your body. And they're called CB1 and CB2, not very creative names. They stand for cannabinoid 1 and cannabinoid 2. And there is more to the story, and it's going to continue to evolve. There are three more receptors which were already known to be involved in processes in our bodies, which are also involved and respond in various ways to cannabinoids. And there is a third cannabinoid being looked at currently.
So you're saying that we have receptors in our brain and receptors all over our body.
All over our body.
And part of the reason is because we actually make our own cannabinoids.
That's correct.
And what happens when we take imbibe cannabinoids in one form or another?
So they interact with these receptors in various very complicated ways. THC will interact in a large way with CB1 receptors and adheres to the CB1 receptors. If you were to generalize on the receptors and where they are, CB1 receptors are more prominent in the central nervous system, and CB2 receptors are more prominent in the immune system. But there is a lot of overlap. A lot of people think that possibly THC interacts with CB1 receptors, which is true, and CBD perhaps interacts with CB2 receptors. This is what a lot of my patients come in thinking. It's actually much more complicated. It is true about the THC, but CBD has very complicated interactions in our body. It tends to raise our own anandamide by preventing the breakdown of our own endocannabinoid, but it does not interact directly with the receptors.
Now, the difference between THC and CBD?
THC and CBD are simply two of the 144 cannabinoids identified in the plant thus far. And they have very different effects, as do all of the other cannabinoids, many of which we don't know much about as yet. Ongoing studies are happening now. But THC is intoxicating, CBD is not intoxicating. I also want to say that when they've looked at other animals and looking at this receptor system, they've found this whole endocannabinoid system, and endo just means within, we make it within, in all animals they've looked at except for insects and crustaceans, which is why at the dispensaries these days you will see pet products.
So I could get something for my cat?
You could, and I can tell you my story. I lost my elderly cat Boris this year, but his last 2 years were much better because of using cannabis. He had stopped purring for 2 years. He did not want to be touched. I knew he had arthritis just by the way he behaved when he jumped off a couch. But and I did not know his age because he was adopted as an adult from the Humane Society. And I tried everything from the vet, nothing helped. And finally I went, well, let's try cannabis. So I didn't want to get him intoxicated. So I tried 20 to 1 tincture, 20 parts CBD to 1 part THC. And when you have them together, they work much better than separate. So not intoxicating at all. And it was salmon flavored for cats, which is not entirely necessary, but that's what I started him on. I gave him half a dropper full twice a day, and in 24 hours he was purring, he would not stop asking for pats, and he had a great last 2 years of his life.
Well, I'll have to seriously consider this for mine. Let's go on with the studies. The National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine came out with a report in 2017 on the health effects of cannabis and cannabinoids. It's a thick book, but can you give us a synopsis?
I can. And this is the third time they've done this. And it happens, it wasn't on purpose, but every 17 years for 3 books now, they have reviewed the literature and scientific studies on cannabis. This time it was published in 2017. It was 16 internationally recognized experts in the world of cannabis, a vast array of specialty backgrounds, and they started with 24,000 abstracts. They removed case reports, editorials. They wanted absolutely scientific studies. So they focused on 10,700 systematic reviews and primary research, which was also often lab research of receptors and cannabinoids. And they put great effort into avoiding bias. They looked at 11 categories of conditions. And in each one, they looked at research gaps and how much evidence there was. So they judged substantial evidence, moderate evidence, limited, or really no evidence. Substantial evidence came out for 3 things, and it doesn't mean it doesn't work for other things. It just means that we do not have the studies yet. So 3 things came up with strong evidence, and one is chronic pain in adults. The other 2, just so you know, are control of nausea with chemotherapy patients and improved spasticity symptoms in multiple sclerosis patients. And the reason that we have that data on MS is that GW Pharmaceuticals in Great Britain developed Sativex, which is a sublingual spray, and they studied it with multiple sclerosis. So we have lots of research for MS patients, which is really nice, and we get to look at that. And the other nice thing is that this company used actual plants to develop their medicine. They didn't make a little white powder in a lab. And they made it half CBD, half THC into a spray that you use under your tongue. So we have the advantage of looking at that.
You are tuned in to Through the Eyes of Women. I'm Corinne Fregoni, and you're listening to Dr. Diane Dickinson, and we're talking about the medical aspects of cannabis. Why is research so difficult in this country?
The Controlled Substance Act was passed in 1970, and it involves 5 schedules which all drugs which are prescribed are put on. Schedule 1 is the most restrictive, and approval to study Schedule 1 drugs is very difficult, and there is limited funding to do that. The definition of Schedule 1 medications are currently no accepted medical use, a high potential for abuse, and a lack of accepted safety. That is where they put cannabis. And if you look at the scheduled drugs, and they list it as marijuana, and it's cannabinoids on the list, it is with heroin, LSD, MDMA, which is ecstasy, peyote, other medications which are being studied now for their therapeutic effects, many of those. But there are actual cannabinoid medications on 4 schedules now, but they were developed by pharmaceutical companies. 2 of them were synthesized, and just added to Schedule 5 is Epidiolex, a plant-derived CBD formulation for children with epilepsy.
And that just came out recently.
Right. And so it's disconcerting that, you know, marijuana and its cannabinoids are in Schedule 1, and yet they are okaying other forms of cannabinoid medication on other schedules.
As long as a pharmaceutical makes money off of it, that's an editorial. Now, let's go into the meat of the matter. What is the definition of chronic pain?
I would say, in my experience with patients, pain which is ongoing or recurrent, which interferes with functioning in life and interrupts all kinds of activities, work, sleep, ability to enjoy activities, sexual activity included, and it really diminishes their life experience.
And it's very subjective.
It is very subjective, and there's no way to evaluate someone's extent of pain.
And how do cannabinoids work for pain?
Well, I don't know that we know everything about how they work, but what I hear from patients is very interesting. Opioids, when you take it for pain, interrupt the signal to your brain. Cannabinoids work very differently. And what patients report to me is that if they use cannabis for their pain and they sit back and go, wow, I feel better, they can put their mind to their lower back, for instance, and go, oh, yeah, the pain is still there. But it's not right in front of their face and interrupting their life. It puts it in a different spot in their brain so they can function. So on a molecular basis, I don't think we know the whole story. One reason that it is very safe is that there are not receptors for cannabinoids in the brainstem, which is what keeps you breathing. There are lots of opioid receptors there, which is why people die of overdoses of narcotics, because it just depresses your respiratory rate, but it does not happen with cannabinoids.
Has there been a decrease in opioid use in the states where cannabis has been legalized?
There's been a significant decrease. And when they've looked at Medicare patients and Medicaid patients in a couple of studies over many states, and the daily dose of just picking up prescriptions and going through them is what they're studying, has decreased by millions of daily doses in the states that have cannabis available to people. It also has lowered use of antidepressants and anti-anxiety medications. And anxiety and depression can be part of dealing with chronic pain.
Are there dangers when using cannabis?
There are some things to be aware of. You will not die from an overdose. You can be completely miserable. You can feel kind of seasick and with disequilibrium and nausea. Some people become anxious. Basically, the way to avoid that is to start on a low dose and slowly increase. It is when a neighbor hands you a brownie they made and that you have no idea the milligrams of any medication in that people get in trouble. And just trouble that they're not happy. They don't feel good. And one thing I want to add is that if you're using it with animals, you also need to go very slowly and start very low. Dogs actually have more CB1 receptors apparently than humans in some studies I've looked at. So they are more sensitive to THC. So you have to be very careful with dogs. You know, there's other dangers. There's some interactions with medications, not very many though. And it's the way that cannabis is metabolized. And it is a blood thinner Coumadin. And in theory, although I have not seen this, you may have to increase that dose. And then anti-seizure medications, sometimes you have to decrease the doses as you use cannabis to control seizures. And that's often in children that no medication is working in. The parents go to try that.
Can you get addicted?
I think you can get habituated. I think addiction, and there's certainly lots of opinions on this. Cannabis use disorder is in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the 5th edition, which is a psychiatric tome listing the criteria for every psychiatric illness. They combined in the last issue cannabis abuse and cannabis dependence into cannabis use disorder. It's very misleading, and I don't agree with a lot of the criteria for cannabis use disorder, but you certainly can overdo it. And the one thing that they found with the National Academies report is it can decrease motivation. It can affect school performance. So it's something to be aware of in teens. With teens, there's a lot of controversy. There's talk of changes in the actual structure of brains with early use. There's actually discussion of decreased IQ points. This has not been shown to be true when carefully reviewed by very responsible organizations. They were derived from poorly designed studies that did not control for other factors. It has been shown that with early alcohol use, there is a lowering of IQ possible. And another study that was very well designed looked at changes in the structure of brains in both adults and adolescents, and it was found not to be true. Now, I don't think we know everything. I think if teens can avoid every stimulating chemical through their teen years, that would be ideal. I don't think that's very realistic. But the fears that are out there are unwarranted.
If somebody's interested in taking in some cannabis, is there an age that you would say wait until?
The legal age is 21, obviously, and I don't think there is a year. I do see at this point, I work as a cannabis consultant as well as do primary care. And at this point, I'm seeing people that want education, and I also have a number of patients under age 21 that I see because I cannot legally access it. But my youngest patient is a toddler with a tumor, and so I don't think there is one right age. It depends on what's going on in your medical condition.
Who opposes legalization?
The main lobbyists that I see are the alcohol industry, because alcohol use has gone down in states that have looked at that have legalized it recreationally. Also pharmaceutical industries and the private prison industrial complex. Those are heavy lobbyers against cannabis use.
Prison industrial complex is opposed because?
Many, many people are in prison for cannabis use, and it is a moneymaker for them.
That's interesting. Let's go back a little to some of the side effects that people are very concerned about. I've heard of the gateway theory. Tell us about that.
The gateway theory is the theory that any medication or drug or illicit substance could be the start of going to stronger things. Like, for instance, some people think you go from cannabis to cocaine and methamphetamine and heroin. In 1999, the Institute of Medicine, which has now been combined into the Academy of Sciences, looked carefully at the evidence. They found no causal link to subsequent use of illicit drugs. And many users of cannabis begin with tobacco and alcohol use, so possibly those are the gateway drugs. There's also a theory that legalization may be anti-gateway because you are taking the drug dealers out of the equation, and often drug dealers are dealing more than just cannabis, so people are not getting exposed to those other illicit substances.
What resources do you recommend for those in the audience who are interested in getting more information?
My two favorite websites are Project CBD, which was developed by two volunteers in 2010 when more and more research was coming in on CBD and they thought having a central place would be good. There is a newsletter to sign up for on their website. It's really not a newsletter. What it is when they add a news article, which averages about every 2 weeks, it would go to your email. I think the most important website, though, is healer.com, and that is the website of Dustin Sulak, who's an osteopathic physician in Maine. He is quite amazing. He has programs for dosage on his website. He has an 8-page document on use of cannabis to reduce and replace opioid medications, and it's really very well done and a great resource.
Well, we've covered a lot of information. What are your most important take-home points?
I'd say prohibition is a failed public health policy. It sincerely is. Cannabis must be rescheduled by the federal government to allow research, preferably descheduled, because this is a botanical. It does not fit into that scheduling group well at all. It is a harm reduction safe alternative or adjunct to pain control with no risk of overdose, death from cannabis. And when combined with opiates, this is really important, both the dose of the opiate and the risk of overdose can decrease. When people use each dose, every time they take a narcotic, if they use a little bit of cannabis at the same time, 1 in 1 does not equal 2 in pain control. It goes to 4 or 5. People get much better pain control and they can decrease their opiate dose. It also can treat the symptoms associated with decreasing or stopping opiate use, including nausea, abdominal cramps, agitation, anxiety, insomnia. It really can help with that entire process.
If I was a patient and I wanted to use cannabis, what would be the advantage of my seeing you for a consult versus just going to a dispensary and trying to figure it out on my own?
For people that want to understand how this is working in their bodies with the endocannabinoid system and have a good understanding of that, I can explain that very well. I spend an hour with new patients and I go at least an hour and go over all of this. I cannot prescribe a particular dose. That is still illegal and called aiding and abetting. But I can make suggestions, and I make suggestions as to formulations and products that I see working for people in the same situations. So when people want really direct information and learning, I think there's an advantage to come to me. But a lot of people can access medication when they have an idea of what they want to try without coming for a medical certificate anymore, which is making access a lot easier for people.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all your information about this amazing plant. You've been listening to Through the Eyes of Women. I'm your host, Corinne Fragoni. My guest today was Dr. Diane Dickinson, and we've been talking about cannabis as medicine. To learn more about this amazing plant, one of the websites that Diane recommended was healer.com. Through the Eyes of Women is a collaborative, voluntary team effort produced for KHSU located at Humboldt State University. Thanks to today's engineer and editor, Jesse Eden. You can listen to the show again at khsu.org or visit our blog at khsuwomen.com, where you can post listener comments. Join us again next Monday at 1:30 right here on KHSU.